Good morning. How auspicious that Bill is here today. You know, your name came up in yesterday's Dharma talk because people around here like stories. So I was telling some stories about no abode, hermitage, and I think that's where I met Bill, probably, yeah. And that Bill used to come to almost all the sesshins. Every month we had sesshin there. Yeah. Bill would faithfully arrive each month from who knows where. Do you remember any particular stories from No Abode that I might have missed? Things were pretty simple, huh? Not much happened there.
Did you bring food, Bill?
Sometimes Bill brought food. Everyone would get plugged into something or other, huh? I was saying how we would do the takohatsu practice and whatever food came. And yet we never went hungry. I remember when we decided to do that practice, we posted on the wall of No Abode for inspiration this section from Dogen's Zui Monkey. The section, it's a longer talk where Buddha says, "Students of the way, don't worry about food and clothing. Just maintain the Buddha's precepts and don't engage in worldly affairs. There's always abandoned clothes and food to be received. In what age will these two things ever be exhausted? As long as your do-like human life lasts, only think of the Buddha way and don't be concerned with other things." And then someone asked Dogen, "Although fame and profit are difficult to give up, since pursuing them is a great obstruction to practicing the way, they ought to be abandoned. So I gave them up," someone said. "Although clothing and food are minor things, these are big matters for practitioners." I think in some of those like Theravada monasteries, basically all they have is three robes and maybe some accessory cloths and an alms bowl and the food that comes into it. So when that's all there is, then they become a really big deal. I've heard stories of like, you know, that there's people get obsessed about getting a new begging bowl, and, you know, what kind of bowl it is, and like maybe their robes should be like this or that. And it's like there's nothing else to put energy into because they don't have anything else. So those become the big things. You know, clothes from abandoned rags and begging food are practices of superior people. And these are just a custom in India. In China, you know, there's always been communities to take care of these things. And this practice of alms round has not been transmitted to our country of Japan. So what should people like us do? Even says, this person talking to Dogen says, "If someone like me tries to gather alms from faithful believers, I'll be committing a sin by receiving a donation without having virtue." So like, I actually really shouldn't do this practice because I don't have enough virtue to do it. And I think for my own case, when we were doing this practice of kind of living on alms at no abode, one of the things that became clear to us early on was that these are donations from faithful people, even if they're not Buddhist practitioners. They're giving on faith that they're giving to practitioners. We don't know what you strain people with these strange big hats and weird clothes are doing, but it seems like it's some kind of spiritual practice, and that seems like a good thing. We'll support that. And so faithful, even as non-Buddhist practitioners, to not even have to ask, well, what exactly is your practice, and then I'll decide if I want to give. No, just, I trust you. I think it's the donor's trust in the practice of whatever these strange people are doing. And it became clear early on for us that we really have to honor that. So we didn't, I mean, the food gets eaten, but for example, the money that came, we're like, we have to be really careful how we use this. Like, we'll just use it for practice. Like, sometimes it went to Dharma books and it went to the utilities at the temple. And sometimes we didn't have a bank account or anything. We just had this big bag, and a lot of it was coins. It would get heavier and heavier, a kind of petty cash bag. And sometimes during interim times, we're like, let's rent a movie or something like this. And it became this topic for big debate. We would just decide we can't spend this money for that. And I think that was a beautiful gift of living that way for me. It's like we have to be really honest, and because people are giving faithfully like this, we have to use it carefully. And I know in myself, before and after that time when I feel like I'm earning my keep, which I think if I look deeper, I think it's never really the case. You can look at any job that you're doing for income as actually always just receiving a gift. You're giving a gift and you're receiving a gift, and you might have an arrangement that my gift to you for this number of hours earns this many dollars per hour, but it's really like we just have that arrangement, but really I'm just giving my time and work, and you're giving your something back. And it's not even, it looks like a deal, but it's not even really. I offer that as a way to look at just work in the world. You can just, it's the same thing, right? It's just like an attitude. I'm just giving this. I said, would I give it if I didn't get paid? Maybe. Let's imagine I would. Because it's just, I want to help. And then, oh, wow, somebody actually paid me. Amazing.
May I disagree with that?
Okay.
I think that's a fundamental difference between the economy of the world, capitalism, having a job, being employed, and the economy of gifts, which occurs in the world of practice between some practitioners and other practitioners, lay people and monastics or whatever you want to say. And the former...
because no deal is made.
It's a deal. It's a legal obligation. Mm-hmm. You can't, as someone who's employed, decide, you know, I really don't feel why I can sincerely perform my job today. So rather than doing it insincerely... I'm going to not work. And you can't, as an employer, be like, well, times are tough in our business. We can't really afford to pay the employees right now. Like, it would really put a strain on our finances. So we're not going to do it. They'll understand. There's a legal obligation going both ways. Or in the world of practice, it's it's freely given, and if the lay people, for whatever reason, cannot give, then that's okay. And if the monastics
can't practice
or feel for whatever reason on a certain day that they can't give a Dharma talk or they can't lead a retreat.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than doing so insincerely, they'd be like, I don't think today would be the day, perhaps tomorrow or the next week. So I really think it's the economy of gifts that occurs in the practice world is wonderful, and it would be great if that were the case everywhere else.
Okay, well, I can see how I can see the distinction. There's a difference, and I think that is the beauty of the Buddha's vision. It looked like the Buddha had this vision of, let's create an economy of gifts, and based on trust and love, and it's worked for 2,500 years in many countries quite well, and so I think there is that difference, and at the same time, I think because this is a householder community, people are working in the world, if we're in that kind of situation, I think it's also possible to internally look at our work in the world in this different way. So maybe it's, you know, physically, outwardly, it doesn't appear, there are some deals and legal contracts, but I think as an attitude, if we're in such a situation, I think we can look at it as like, let me make my job just a gift. I have no request from my employer, you know, if they can do that practice if they want. Or if we're the employer, maybe we see, let me make my offerings to my employee a gift, whether or not it depends on what they do. So even though it has this kind of structured legal type form, I think as practitioners, we can treat it at least a little bit that way. And another example would be we've talked about in this session, nothing whatsoever should be clung to as me or mine, talking about particularly the body and thoughts and stuff, but of course this also means property. And I think if, as practitioners, if we look deeply, we see that nobody actually really owns anything. You know, you look deeper. It's a conventional agreement that if you really step back and look at it, you see, isn't it amazing how well we agree? I mean, some people don't agree, like thieves actually say, I don't agree with that society's idea that you own that. I'm going to own it now. You know? But basically, it's amazing that in general, societies all over the world, we pretty much agree like, this piece of paper with writing on it means like you own this house. It's completely made up human construct, but because we all agree, it works pretty well. It's like people don't fight about that too much, and we have courts and stuff that help back up the illusion. But there are examples. Like I think when the white man came into America at first, the Native Americans, maybe there was some sense of different tribes taking care of certain territories, and they would maybe fight about that. So maybe some sense of loose sense of ownership without any written contracts. And then the white man came and basically with their own structure kind of said like, well, we have a different idea about this. Now we own it. And look, here's the piece of paper, right? And the natives were like, huh? Piece of paper? And so you have to get off. It's our land now. We have the paper to prove it. How ridiculous, right? But and how painful. And but then once it got set in place, then okay, let's all agree. It'll make things work smoothly. But as practitioners, we can also see whatever possessions we might have as like let's, you know, it's a convention, we live in a conventional world, let's play that game because it does work smoothly, but let's not really believe that I actually own it. And therefore, when it gets stolen, broken, burnt, crushed, destroyed, disintegrated, then it's like, well, that's part of the impermanent world. So, anyway, I think this was one of the lessons I felt like in living in, that gift economy, more than living in the contract economy, it kept me more honest. That time at No Abode, I actually felt like we can't use it. We can't just do some entertaining thing for ourselves. It doesn't really seem like we're wholeheartedly practicing for the benefit of all beings. Whereas now, if I feel like I'm getting paid via contract or something, then I feel fine. I can do whatever I want. You know, I fall into the illusion. It's harder to stay honest with myself. You know what I mean?
I think the difference is in the capitalist contractual economy, when you get paid, the money is going to you specifically. You can do whatever you want with it. Whereas in the gift economy, it's not like those people, like they weren't giving to you specifically. Mm-hmm. They were giving to the practice.
Yeah. I think
whether they knew what that was or not, mm-hmm. they were giving to practice, and so you felt.
Yeah, I think that's particularly true of Takuhatsu. Like if you have in some of these countries and even this country, there can be people with like kind of individual sponsors where it's like, I want to support you as a practitioner, but please take this and do whatever you want with it and please really enjoy it. Even that has a little different feeling. It's like, okay, well there's a personal thing and they put it that way, but Takuhatsu, because it's anonymous, even the way that at No Abode had that same feeling that I think the Buddha intended, and the intent of these big, big hats that block your face, so that people are giving to the Sangha, and as an archetype, as a whole, as opposed to individuals, that makes it even more imperative to be really upright with how we use gifts given to the Sangha.
That hat, also, you can't see who's giving things to?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the symbolic setup. In effect, you can actually often look up and see. But sometimes not, you know. If you try to really keep your head straight and the hat horizontal, then yeah, right, you don't see either way. There's a hand reaching out that you see the hand, and you see your hands, they see your hands, and a bowl, and it's an exchange. And I think that's why it's important actually to keep the form of, there was maybe some discussion, should we wear robes and all that? And I'm like, yeah, otherwise, what is it? You know, it's just, again, just a conventional archetype, but like, the robes are the symbol for the Sangha. Right? People can understand that.
It's interesting. It brings up the idea in my mind about a homeless person hanging out in a left turn lane waiting for gifts, whether it's money. And I, you know, if I have groceries in the car, you hand an apple out the door. And then you don't concern yourself with, oh, is this going to be used well?
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. does the person really need food or just want to get high or get, you know, intoxicated? And so letting go of that idea and just exercising dana,
yeah.
right? Just saying, I want to support this person. Mm-hmm. Their practice is living,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I have to give up the thought of how they're living
yeah.
or what they're doing, but just giving without the idea
yeah.
of worrying about
very much. I think so. That's for the donor, their practice is to give wholeheartedly, even to evil monks, everybody equally, and to the people who aren't practitioners at all. And I do whatever you want with it. go whatever. And because that's wholeheartedly giving with no reservation. So that's the practice for the giver. And then for the receiver, as a practitioner, then we say, oh, may I use this very kind gift, may I use it wholeheartedly. Always we could look at that. May I use whatever means, even if I've earned them, hopefully it benefits others. And sometimes my enjoyment is going to end up benefiting others. We could say, like, I need to relax. I really need to watch a movie now. I'm so stressed out, and therefore, it'll be helpful to others tomorrow when I'm more relaxed. There's maybe some Dharma inspiration in this movie. I personally love movies, especially good ones. That often they do have some, I think, they're well-done movies, usually do have, even they have nothing to do with Buddhism, but they have some inspiration for practice, some life theme. So.
I just wanted to say about the discussion that you guys were having. This is a practice that I've had taken up, this attitude, you know, this approach to things, to, like, well, you know, let's see how it works. To just kind of have that attitude with things. And so, very rarely, I'd say almost never at this point, do I actually have a written agreement with somebody.
In your work, huh?
Yeah.
Is that kind of unusual, maybe?
Maybe. Hmm. And, like, you know, those benches that are made that you saw, you know, they asked me, oh, do you want a deposit? Do you want some money for this up front? And I said, no, that's okay. You know, you don't have to worry about that. Just with the trust that when I finished, and we set a price, we agreed upon a price, that when they were done and I brought them, they agreed upon like they did. But if they didn't, you know, which... very rarely is the case, actually, you know.
Yeah.
So you just kind of put yourself out there with that trust and just kind of look at it with an attitude that way. And also about the, well, I don't feel, you know, like I can really show up, you know, completely wholeheartedly today. So I'm just going to stay home, you know. You show up no matter what. You know. I mean, a lot of times I show up.
Because that is the gift.
Yeah, just, you know, times when I'm going to go do a job or whatever and I really don't want to go do it. But you just do it.
But there, maybe the key point here is you really don't want to, but you do it anyway. But do you do it out of obligation or as a gift? That's, I think, the key.
Well,
I have to because I have the contract versus I don't want to, but, like, it actually will be helpful to my employer or whatever. So I do it as a gift to them, not because I have to. I think the whole contractual world sets up a feeling of obligation, whereas I think what Alex is pointing to is like, can there be free giving, which sometimes is like not just whatever we want, sometimes really wholehearted, you know, inconvenient, going out of our way, but not out of obligation.
Up to the same thing could be applied to practice too, though. You know, I don't really want to go to something. You know,
yeah, yeah.
But
same.
I'm going to go. Anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't really want to. You know,
but not out of obligation. How about go, you know?
Maybe it might look good.
And maybe it's a fine line. Yeah. Obligation, meaning like, obligation to the Sangha, might mean like, I want to go for the Sangha, but as a gift to the Sangha, maybe very close to obligation. I guess I'm using the word obligation to mean like, well, I don't feel like it's a gift. I think that's what I mean, because I have to.
And I'll notice with myself is in both of those situations, usually a shift will occur somewhere.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't really want to go to something, but I feel obligated to go. Mm-hmm. And then when I get there, it's like, oh, I'm really glad I came.
Totally, yeah.
You know, it's the same thing with work.
Yeah.
But then when I get there, yeah, and start doing it, it's like,
very much so. The beauty of practice is that shift can happen any moment. So, can total obligation mode and just in the usual setup and then shift. And like the very same activity, no one even notices, but now there's this different attitude about it. Just you could call that dropping off body and mind. Maybe that's a little bit exalted way to say it, but just letting go of like my attitude of trying to get something out of this or resisting this to like the very same activity is now freely just doing.
And I can only think of, all my working, there's probably only a couple times out there where, I put myself out there that openly with that much trust, where there's been a couple people that have gone, oh, look at this guy, look at this foolish person who's put himself out there to be taken advantage of. I might as well take advantage of it. It's really...
But it has happened.
Like I said, I can only think of maybe once or twice where something like that has happened. So...
Yeah, I think this is like sometimes maybe it's going out on a limb, but because it's such a fundamental aspect of practice, I think we're talking about these practical matters of working in the world and livelihood and money and things, but I think the principle is the principle of zazen, actually. It's so fundamental to practice, it seems to me, that it has to do both with not reifying the world and all our human constructs, and has to do with acknowledging the Buddha nature in everyone. These are some of the aspects that the trust comes from, and that by trusting it, seeing into those truths can be aided in some ways by the trust. And the trust can develop from seeing into those truths. Zazen, it's like just, I trust whatever arises this day of sitting in my mind or in this room will be okay. And then like, we do that in zazen, but then these are like examples. Now let's bring it out into the real world. Now that's where we have to get serious. We put aside these practice principles because livelihood is very serious. Is a big issue for everyone. Actually, I think. That the practice, the mind, the trusting mind, come in to such areas. And somebody else said to Dogen, your way of practice is extreme. You don't understand this age. The 1200s. And do not reflect upon your capability. This is the degenerate age. If you continue to practice in that way, Dogen, it will become a cause of backsliding. This person is quite something, huh? To talk to Dogen like that. I recommend, Dogen, that you should seek the support of some patron. Take care of your body by living in a quiet place without worrying about food or clothing, and practice the Buddha way peacefully. This isn't being greedy for property or belongings. First, provide for your temporal means of livelihood, and then practice. Be practical, Dogen. Dogen says, although I listened to his advice, I do not yet believe it. And Dogen says, all of the customs of India, China, and Japan are all different, that the mode of the way has always been like this. Just practice the way. Don't store up a lot of extra stuff. If we learn the way in the morning, we should not mind dying in the evening. In 10,000 kalpas and thousands of lives, how many times are we born and how many times do we die? It's just samsara caused by blind and clinging. Moreover, I think this is the part that we posted on the wall of No Abode. Moreover, I've never read in the collection of all the Buddhist sutras of a single Buddha or ancestor who transmitted Dharma in the three countries dying of starvation or cold. I never heard of that either. Maybe some people got close, like the Buddha. But in this world, inherently, each person receives a certain amount of food and clothing as a gift. It does not come by being sought after, nor does it stop coming by not seeking after it. Just leave it to fate and don't worry about it. Right? Is that magical thinking? Inherently, each person receives a certain amount. It sounds like it's kind of predetermined. It's a funny way of talking, I think. Inherently, each person, and if you try to get more, you actually won't, because it's already preset. And if you try to get less, or you try to avoid it, it's going to come anyway. It's almost like at birth, it's like the kind of gross income of that person is kind of like written on their like karmic tab or something. If you refrain from arousing bodhicitta in this life, excusing yourself on the grounds that it's the degenerate age, in what life will it be possible to realize the way? So I like that. Leave it to fate. Don't worry about it. It's going to come. It's not going to come. Just practice. In the modern times, Shodo Harada Roshi, a great Rinzai Zen teacher with many American students, says, the mind of no worry, no anxiety. This is the difference between truly leaving home and leaving home only in form. This is nice because it's like, we're often talking about what is this leaving home in modern times, and it's like, well, we don't necessarily have this really renunciate lifestyle and vows of celibacy and these kinds of things. So here's one thing we could say. It doesn't depend on any particular precepts or any particular forms. Just the mind of no worry and no anxiety. That's like truly leaving home, and therefore doesn't necessarily involve ordination or anything like that. It could just be living at home and leaving attachment behind. To worry about your life and what it will bring you is for people of the world. To be able to totally entrust, leaving everything up to the workings of the cosmos. Only if you do true zazen will you be able to understand the state of mind. I very much like what Dogen says, and interesting that he says, you know, if you try to kind of like force yourself to think that way or something, that's not it. You can't really do that either. It's only through zazen, or you could say the mind of zazen, the mind of letting go of the future. When we can live without great concern for our own welfare, the food we need usually comes. He says, usually. He says, in doing takuhatsu, I have never had a single day of receiving no offerings. And, you know, it's interesting. It's all relative. We have this time of kind of economic crisis, big changes in the economy, which I don't really know that much about. It doesn't seem to have affected me. I don't have enough for it to affect me so far, it looks like. But I have a friend who doesn't have that much, but due to various investments, he lost a huge amount of his savings in the economic changes. And it was like, as a practitioner, he was like, for like a couple years after that, he said he was like, that was like, my practice felt like it was out the window. I was just constantly like annoyed and really angry and depressed, and like I lost so much. And I think that's naturally if you lose a huge percentage of what you have, then it's just the loss itself naturally creates those feelings. But in actuality, you know, even what he was left with is much more than I have. So it's just relative. But in fact, also his lifestyle didn't really change. I think that's when we really maybe start to notice, oh, I lost enough so that like I really have to like actually sell off various things, and then it's, you know, it's having a big effect. Even then, it's all relative. Right? So I think it's a tall order, the mind of no worry and no anxiety about the future. I guess this is challenging. And also in there is when we're like, I think Zazen like this too, when we're less concerned about how it's going for us and more like, well, let me just make it all a gift. Let me make my Zazen a gift. Everything becomes, how can I cause the living beings to enter the Buddha way? Then there is less worry and anxiety. So it's just, again, that shift of, may I, and you could call it mind training, intentional cultivation of mind training. May I make my Zazen a gift? May I make showing up and sleeping through Zazen, even though I really don't want to even go, may I make that a gift? Even if there's nobody else there to appreciate it, may I make it a gift? It's just, gift is an internal heart attitude. So on the shifting gears a little bit, on the just to bring up this one point, because a couple people talked to me about Zazen and trying out this using the present moment as the object of mindfulness. Again, any object of mindfulness, when we're applying mindfulness to the object, we have alertness that's monitoring the mindfulness, checking like, are you still on the object? It's working together with mindfulness. It's like another like part of the mind that's monitoring, and then the relaxation, the whole thing is like just more and more settled. Those three working together with any object. If they're working together well, then that will create a buoyant, calm abiding. And the breath is a particularly good object because it's relatively easier to find and stay with. Mindfulness tied to that post of the breath. So if we try, and some people have talked to me and said, I practice with the breath when my mind is a little bit more discursive, and then from the breath, then at some point I'll gradually expand it to, like, I'm going to open up the object of mindfulness is now the present experience, a little more peripheral, including a little bit more. And I myself often do this too. Start with the breath and then open it up or back and forth. Breath is very good, especially for the relaxation part, making sure the breath is very deep and relaxed. So if we have this wider field as the object, it's a little bit harder because it's wider. It's harder to stay focused on. It's a bigger object. The rope is not just tied around this small post of the breath. The rope is tied around the entire present moment. So it's easy for the whole thing to kind of like slip through. So I would say if we switch from the, and I think it's also good to be conscious, to consciously know my object is the breath now, and now my object is the present, instead of just leaving it to fate. Sometimes by the end of Sesshin, this whole thing gets so loose that maybe leaving it to fate, something like that, maybe works. But I think it's helpful that now on three, we're going to make the shift. This is still a specific object called the present moment. But I would propose that if we do that, then it's nice to, that monitor called alertness has to almost like, I think he should almost like stand up. He's sitting in his chair. Yeah, we're like watching over here. Now it's like, you're going to open up the object like that? Okay, stand up. I'm Shashu. He's like, turn up the dial on the alertness one. I think we have to do that because it's harder to stay with, which is why it might not be a good thing to if the mind's pretty wandering. That's why the breath is particularly good. So this is just very personal, up to each person. But I noticed that point. These three qualities, if we expand the object to be the entire present experience, I think the alertness monitor has to be really cranked up there, really alert. And another interesting teaching, I think, is this is from one of my Tibetan teachers talking about these types of meditation. I think there's some wisdom in this, that people newer to practice, newer practitioners, when working with this whole present moment as the object, the main pitfall that they fall into is mistaking that type of practice, confusing that type of practice with just basically kind of like spacing out. Spacing out, I think, is just like, we're just kind of like being here. We're not too caught up in anything. But we're like actually not focused either. The mind's, there's an undercurrent of just sort of dream-like wandering. And that's not what we're talking about, this diligent mindfulness of the present experience with this strong alertness. So newer practitioners, they confuse those two. And I think a lot, I think I hear this kind of thing maybe implied sometimes when talking about just sitting. Oh, it's just sitting. It's like, we're just being here. But it's really like, it's this sort of this dull, habitual, dream-like, like no effort, but like no attention either. So that pitfall, and I would say the way to confuse those two, you see what those two are, the difference between. And I think the difference between them, to clarify the difference, it's this one. It's turning up the volume on the alertness factor. If the alert, I think that's what spaced out means. In my vocabulary, would be the alertness factor is just, not only is he not standing up, but he's actually just like taking a nap. He's reading a magazine or something. And so meanwhile, the mindfulness goes off, but the alertness is just not even keeping track. So that's for newer practitioners. And then for more like long-term practitioners who are working with this particular type of meditation, the pitfall they fall into is confusing this mindfulness of the present moment as the object of our experience. They confuse that with non-dual awareness, Buddha nature, the mirror. It's a, maybe it's a subtler confusion. And there, in that case, you could say, what is the difference there that they're confusing? The difference is that the present moment is still an object of awareness. And it should be, I think, in this shamatha practice, where mindfulness is leashed to this object called the present moment. And it's a specific object. It's just a very wide one, and it's changing all the time. But it's specific in that it's called the present moment. It's not various things such as past and future. So I think this is a very subtle shift, and that's why we often get into these discussions. I think about in the sesshin, I think it was me saying something like, "Well, I'm on the fence about this, you know, the present moment being the heart of the matter." I said something like that. And I think I would say that's because is the present moment still an object? Because in non-dual awareness, there are no objects, and time is a very, very subtle object, but I suppose it is an object. Even the present moment, as opposed to past and future, the sense of now as opposed to non-dual awareness is actually timeless. I think, we might say this is being nitpicky, the difference between presence and timelessness experientially. Oh, that's like a hair's breadth. So maybe being nitpicky, that's why this teacher says that's a confusion for kind of advanced practitioners. Very, very subtle distinction. And so in that case, if that's the distinction, what's the practice? In the first confusion, the practice, to bring it back into the practice of object of present moment from spacing out, you turn up the alertness. In this case, what's the practice to shift from the present moment as object? We could call shamatha without a particular support to non-dual vipassana. What do you think the practice is for that shift? Yeah, I think it's like a complete letting go is one way we could say it. Letting go of any sense of any reference point, like even the present moment being a reference point. And that letting go, I think, sometimes might have the experiential shift that it's just a sense of like total openness and release. But even in the, you know, being really present with the present moment, there's also often quite a bit of openness and release too. So fine line, but the criterion would be, is there any grasping at all? Is there any touching anything, even like the present moment? Therefore, Chan Master Hongjir, describing the mind of Zazen, said, knowing, it is knowing awareness without touching things. And his present moment could be touchable. It's not much to touch, that's for sure. Not much to cling to if it's just the ever-changing flow of the present moment. But is it a time? And also maybe is there any sense of effort? That might be another way to look at the shift. There's still these three factors, mindfulness, relaxation is almost like not an effort. So we could just say, but intentional relaxation, mindfulness, and alertness, at that shift you could say those three like don't require any more effort, and it's just pulled back in. I think that shift is constantly shifting. Sometimes then we lose it completely and we're just a karmic blip comes up and we're back into it, and then we maybe start again. Okay, let's go back to the breath now. So we're like way, we've really lost it. But sometimes it's like weaving back and forth across this very fine line of like present moment. Okay, not even like I don't even remember what's happening here, but it's totally awake, totally freshly awake, but it's not even present. And then we come back into maybe the habitual alertness factors, like, what about me? Like, you just put me out of a job. You put all these factors out of a job, and like, he has been just resting there, and he kind of stands up and says, like, be alert, you know? And then it's like, that pulls us back, actually, right? Because that's a little bit like, are you, or it's just checking. Are you alert? Is it present? Oh yeah, I'm present. But now, in that alert, checking about the present, I actually lost the referencelessness of time, the timeless, reference-free, spaciousness, just by checking.
Yeah. I found that especially as, you know, it's just shame. That one or those ones, they just kind of voluntarily leave.
Yeah, sometimes.
I just realize they're not needed anymore. So,
yeah, but.
Period is often just kind of runs into another one, and it's all just one period.
Maybe a nice way to put it is like that kind of sentry guard, the monitor of alertness is like check watching the mindfulness. But you get more and more settled, and he's like, oh, I'm watching, but the mindfulness isn't veering off. It's like there's less and less for me to do. And at some point, maybe then it's just like, well, I guess I'm not really needed here, and that's when it drop away. And this all can happen just for like a moment, actually. I think in that spaciousness, I think actually staying there in that place, it's no place for any length of time, very unusual. Even though we know that we're always actually there, that's where we actually live. Someone have a question?
In my attempts to go from the breath as object of awareness to the present moment as the object of awareness to abiding in the present moment as this non-dual awareness, I feel like non-dual awareness is so close to the spacing out. It just slips, it just goes right into that without barely even stopping on the non-dual awareness. It's almost like you tell the alert guy, okay, you don't have to do anything anymore, but don't sit down and start enjoying yourself. Don't sit down and start napping or have a cup of coffee or sugar or whatever. I don't need you to do anything, but don't do what you want. Of course, he or she doesn't like that, so that you know, does whatever. Of course, that you know, he's having to do it. So it just this goes right to spacing out every single time without barely stopping for a moment on.
So maybe we could say like really it could be helpful to get really used to having the alertness guy on duty for a while, really just don't send him away too early, so we're in that unsupported shamatha kind of space where alertness is totally functioning, staying with this wider awareness, very very like bright, fresh, kind of like cultivating a very awake quality there, until, almost like we were just saying, until like he actually feels like on his own he's just not necessary, and he goes, maybe it's a, we just got to be careful not to send him away even just a little bit too early, because then it's like if we're not already, almost like there's some momentum, I think, in this, in the creating the brightness, alert mind. It's like it's a cultivation, but then it has its momentum, so that the mind is now so happy to be that way that then these effortful factors can start to step aside, and it can remain for a little bit or slip back into the other. And yeah, sometimes spacing out, but if it immediately goes into spacing out, meaning like the undercurrent of dream-like thinking patterns just immediately just pops back in, then it seems like the bright awakeness of mind, often that's what it seems like, that one is just kind of like shrunk into a darker space. So maybe that we don't even worry about this, that third one too much. We're just another way to practice might be just we're really cultivating the alert attention on the present moment, with all these factors working very smoothly together, just period. And then if they drop away on their own, then so be it. But that's such an excellent practice in itself, and also quite hard to do, also stay really present like that, that we could cultivate that for our life. This is, I think, wonderful to get into these nuances, and some, you know, some might feel like, well, I'm just trying not to like be totally obsessed on my like thinking patterns all day or whatever. But there too, there's any moment the mind is so flexible. You can just be like, okay, I think I'll just like stop now. Pressing the breath. Yeah. Yes.
What I've noticed though in our practice, is there really is nothing you can stick to. You know, I get something, I say, oh, this is what I'm going to do now. I'm going to focus on my breath, and everything's going to just be great. I'm going to enter nirvana for a moment. But it doesn't last. It's like something else comes up, and I go, oh, what's these thoughts doing? Like, what do? You know, it's like there's really nothing you can do. There's nothing that you can stick to. That's the thing about practice, especially, you know, Zen in America, is that, you know, it's sort of a new thing to this country, you know? And it's like, you know, we could spend years studying and still we won't have that right on, this is how to do it answer.
Well, everything is impermanent and constantly shifting, and there's nobody in control. That all seems very true. And yet, also, at the same time, there really is training possible. There really is mind training. There really is setting of strong intention. Strong intention can arise to like, okay, like, my, you know, the hours of my life are being like shaved off moment by moment. And we're just gonna die soon, and look, somehow I ended up in Sesshin. What an amazing opportunity. This is the best conditions for being present. So even though it's very hard, over and over again, and so I think, you know, although I like to, you know, talk about the immediacy and sudden style, I think in actuality, the way it plays out, and I know just from my own life, there's this very gradual process. I would even say, even just in the past few years for me, my zazen is quite different than it was for, you know, 18 years or something.
Maybe that's the realization that someone makes for practicing so long, is that, you know, that impermanence, that constancy of change, and if one is able to be in that present awareness, you know, just through his practice or her practice, then, you know, there's not a need to have to try to stick to something, because, you know, enlightenment's there already. And if you're not trying to grab, then the whole thing is the mind is ungraspable, you know. And if you're in that, you know, that center, but you're realizing that, you know, maybe that's the exception to not having anything to stick to. You know?
Well, if you're talking about not sticking in that kind of way, like we're like, and sometimes zazen, sometimes this is another kind of practice that I've been playing with. This, I don't even know if we call it practice, but this sesshin is when almost like the mind doesn't want all these refined shamatha and vipassana exercises and stuff. The mind is just like thinking, doing its thing, but there's also this awareness that like all of this is just totally bullshit. It's just illusion. It's just like there's really not holding to it. It's just all the stuff's flowing through, but there's no trying to control it. Sometimes I like sitting like that. It's totally joyful. I think that's the key. It's like if we're holding to it, it's not. But if it's just like, okay, let's just like let the mind just like roll for a while, just do its thing, and it's like, yeah, this is like crazy. This is like an insane person. But actually, I love it. It's so free. It's so freeing and happy. Just let the mind just go do its thing. And it's like, there's nobody like doing this. And there's nobody that it's bothering. And it's just totally fine. If it's that kind of like, I think that's okay. There's room for that. I don't think you find it in the traditional texts so much. Maybe you do. I don't know.
I would say that's like not it.
Could be.
That description, that's what that sounds like to me.
It's like thinking away, thinking, you know, it's just all kinds of stuff, watching the patterns unfold, but really like there's not the slightest wish to like get this under control, come back to the breath, or like this is an interesting one, follow this. It's more just like, blah, 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 blah.
The mind is wrong, but you're not thinking about it.
Yeah, and there's no holding to it. Someone might argue, well, there is, just to be generating that kind of thought, there's some grasping that's generating it, but experientially, it sometimes feels like there's such ease with it. It's just, and I think it's part of the, it's not, I would call it, it's not spaced out. The way I'm talking about spaced out. Spaced out is like, you're in it, but you're also involved in it. You're like, there's the undercurrent, and it's like, oh yeah, that I like that dream, you know, like, oh, that reminds me, oh yeah. This is more like, the monitor is still there, and the monitor is just like, open the floodgates, but still just watching the flood go through, and it's like, totally alert. It's still alert, but it's really not trying to do anything anymore. And sometimes, even in Sesshin, the mind is like, has all this energy, and just, and usually when it's like that for me, it usually doesn't get into repetitive patterns, because I think that takes some grasping. But like the same thing keeps coming up on this obsession, I think that's fed by grasping. This is just like totally random, like nonsense. I don't know, it's kind of weird practice. I don't know if I call it shamatha or vipassana. But if there's a sense that there's no thinker at the center, then maybe we call it some type of vipassana. It sounds quite different if we're saying shikantaza is this non-dual awareness where there's not even the slightest sense of the present anymore. Almost like nothing's happening at all except bright clarity. This sounds almost like the opposite. And yet, some people might call that shikantaza too, like a very energetic flood style of shikantaza. Maybe. But grasping is that, with grasping thought, or emotions, anything in the mind, in our experience, holding to anything in our experience, that seems to be what we call dukkha.
What you're saying is, this is happening, nothing's grasping, and there's also no sense of some independent watcher watching this. It's just happening.
Yeah, and also like not like a self behind it, and so it doesn't even check like, why does this seem so okay? Often just because it's there's nobody who's trying to like get it under control, something like that. So today's Buddha's birthday, or close to it, was celebrated today. So, on that occasion, I must bring up a little story. From Dogen's extensive record, bathing Baby Buddha Dharma Hall Discourse. At the time of the ceremony of bathing Baby Buddha, which we'll perform, or at least we'll do a dress rehearsal later today. Dogen says, today, our original teacher Shakyamuni Tathagata descended to be born at Lumbini Grove. Every year on this day, we always have Lumbini Grove. I thought, that's interesting. Instead of every day, year on this day, we celebrate Buddha's birth. Every day we have Lumbini. Every year at this time we have Lumbini. Maybe this is sort of like a Vajrayana thing of like, now we imagine this is Lumbini Grove. Quiet grove, mountain, is instantly transformed into Lumbini grove, and we are there as the devas, Gandharvas, Kimnaras, and Maharagas to witness the scene. If anybody would like to go to what some people call the actual Lumbini Grove, it looks like we're going to have a pilgrimage in January to go there.
This January?
In southern Nepal. This coming January. Kind of put the word out there on Facebook, and enough people responded that we definitely want to go, that I think we can't avoid it at this point. It's kind of a pain. I'm not sure if I'm totally up for it, but I think it's too late. So if you want to go, start doing takahatsu. You better start now. Every year on this day, we also have Lumbini Grove here. Tell me whether the great sage is born or not. If you say he's descended from 2 feet to heaven to be born, I grant you have done one portion of practice. If you say he has not descended to be born, if he is the unborn Buddha, then I grant you have done one portion of practice. In other words, Buddha being born, saying Buddha is born, is part of it. Saying Buddha is unborn, it's part of it. If you're already like this, then you're not obstructed by mountains or oceans, and will be born into a king's palace like Shakyamuni Buddha. If you can see both that the Buddha was born and that he wasn't born, then you're not obstructed by mountains and oceans, and you too will be born as a Buddha. If you're not obstructed by mountains or oceans, are you obstructed by birth or not? Even if previous Buddhas and ancestors say that they are obstructed by birth, today this mountain monk simply says that I am not obstructed by birth. You sometimes feel obstructed by birth. And Sashin wish he could just be the unborn Buddha mind, don't have to keep being born into a painful body. One more round of zazen, birth. Or are you just not obstructed by that birth? If we're not obstructed by mountains and oceans, we're not obstructed by birth. All people in the entire earth and the entire universe are born together with Shakyamuni Buddha and say in unison and seven-part harmony, above the heavens and down on earth, I alone am the world honored one. Amen. After taking seven steps in the 10 directions, this statement was the Buddha's lion's roar, and it was a baby's crying. How do you express such a manifestation? How do you express such a manifestation? After a pause, Dogen said, in the entire universe and pervading the heavens, good fortune arises. The grandmotherly, intimate heart is expressed by the sages taking birth in this today's Lumbini Grove. How can we make offerings, serve, make prostrations, and bathe baby Buddha to celebrate his descent to birth? Together with the pure, great ocean-like assembly, let us enter the Buddha hall and perform the ceremony. Today we would leave the Buddha hall, go out into the quiet Lumbini Grove. And some people might think that we're performing the ceremony, but really, it's merely a dress rehearsal. There is a ceremony that the Buddha's performing during the dress rehearsal. But we do not take part. Nobody takes part.
Can't take part.
Can't take part. That's one portion of practice, is the actual ceremony that no one takes part in. And the other portion of practice is doing our best in the dress rehearsal. We dedicate any merit gathered here today at the Pure Ocean-like Assembly to the complete awakening of all beings. May they fully enter this birth without obstruction. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.